If you're a fan of Marvel comic books, you might be familiar with an aircraft called the Helicarrier. This thing is a floating base. It's a floating aircraft carrier that's able to launch other smaller aircraft off of it. It sounds really cool. It sounds impossible. It sounds like a work of science fiction. But wait. Hi, I'm Ben.
Is there more? I'm Noel. I'm on the edge of my seat, Ben.
Yes, welcome to Ridiculous History, folks, where you pay for the entire seat, but you only need the edge.
That is... Ben, you are on fire this morning,
thanks,
my friend.
Man,
it is the morning, by the way. Peek behind the curtain. So if we sound a little groggy, you'll know why.
Also, I think that's a figure of speech from an old motorcade show or something. But yes, Noel, there is a little bit more. And with the help of our super producer, Casey Pegram, we won't stand on ceremony. We'll dive right in. So at the offset... That sounds crazy. You're familiar with Marvel movies, right, Noel?
I am, but I just not the minutiae. Like I wouldn't know the vehicle you're talking about, Ben, but it does sound pretty cool and very much in line with a science fact thing we're going to talk about today. But give us the segue.
Oh, sure. So the segue is the following. The reason this idea feels so cool, even in the realm of superhero comics and science fiction, is because you have so much more mobility. For a long, long time, aircraft carriers were juggernauts, and they still are in terms of military hardware, vessels, warfare, and so on, but they are limited in their mobility. They can go close to a coastal area, and they can send jets, right, or other aircraft that can fly over land.
And we're talking about floating aircraft carriers here, as in, like, by sea.
Right, by sea, by sea. But imagine how amazing it would be, in theory, if we could have something that isn't restricted to water, if we could have something that could fly over land itself and then launch smaller craft.
Why, Ben, in theory, that sounds like a fantastic idea.
In theory, Noel, it does. So much so that in the early 20th century, the U.S. Navy started designing a real-life flying aircraft carrier. And this, for everyone who tuned into our previous episode, this is where we get to return to dirigibles. Airships.
I know you are thrilled about this, Ben, because as you've mentioned before on the show, you are a fan of these leviathans of the sky.
I'm into the whole thing aesthetically. I got really close actually a few years ago to riding in the Goodyear blimp.
And, what?
Yeah, and I think I might still do it.
Do you know what? You know a guy?
Yeah, yeah.
Can you hook me up?
Well, that's what I was going to ask, Casey. Noel, do you guys want to go try to hop in the Goodyear blimp?
Could we do an extra credit segment from the Goodyear blimp?
I feel like we would have to.
I think we would have to. We would be duty bound as ridiculous historians.
So let's try to get that off the ground.
Hey.
I don't know if it was worth it.
I think it was worth it, Ben. Everything's worth it, you know?
it's very kind, if a little broad. I appreciate the sentiment. So in a previous episode on how Germany gave up sausages for war, or specifically sausage casing, spoiler alert, we go into some detail about what an airship is, the difference between a blimp and a zeppelin.
That was also the one where I profiled the guy as a Nazi because he had a Nazi-sounding name, and I apologize for that.
Von Graf?
Von Graf. Baron Graf von Zeppelin, and wrong war, Brown.
I think it's a great name.
You know, it's a fantastic name, and I also don't want to imply that every intensely German sounding name has the Nazi ring to it. So, just wanted to get that out of the way right now. I know we had a listener email and point that out, and mea culpa.
You are seen and heard, and I hope you don't beat yourself up, Noel.
I beat myself up about any number of things. This is pretty low on the list, but I did just want to air it out. Since we are, in fact, again, talking about Zeppelins, and the Zeppelin name will come up a little later in this episode.
Yes. So the idea is still here, this amazing possibility, this fascinating concept of an aircraft carrier that now can go anywhere. And when the U.S. Navy started really working on this, they said, you know, I think we can actually pull this off. And so in 1929, November of 1929, they started building the first ever ship of its kind, a new sort of dirigible, at the Goodyear Zeppelin Air Dock in Akron, Ohio.
That's right. And in a burst of creativity, as Ben would like to say, it was called the USS Akron.
Get it? Get it? Because it's in the same...
It's in Akron where they were building it. And it's really interesting because they actually, you know, these government contracts, they go out for bids. And the winner was actually a partnership between the Luftschiffbau Zeppelin Company and the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Corporation. And they had a joint venture called the Goodyear Zeppelin Corporation. And as you said, Ben, they created this partnership in 1923 and set to work immediately building this incredibly enormous ship.
Get some stats?
I got a few stats. So just as a reminder, the difference between a Zeppelin and a blimp is that a Zeppelin has this rigid skeletal structure, these steel rings, almost like a rib cage, and they're divided up. They're called deep rings, actually, and they typically would be 15 meters apart, but with this one, because of the size, they were spaced 22 and a half meters apart. And now, instead of using that intensely flammable hydrogen that we talked about in the previous episode, they were using the much friendlier gas, the noble gas, one of the noblest of gases, helium, right? It was not flammable and fit the bill to make this thing lighter than air. And it also allowed them to do things like, you know, cook. They had a galley on this thing because it was designed to, you know, carry quite a large crew.
Oh, and I think we're burying the lead here a little bit, but if I'm not mistaken, they were also designed to carry up to five of these biplanes that they could deploy. Right, Ben?
Right. Yes, the F-9C Sparrowhawk. Just to give you a sense of perspective here, folks, the ship itself, the Akron itself, is about as long as a 60-story skyscraper is tall. The crew numbered close to 100, right? And they had, you know, they had restrooms. I don't want to be crass, but I just want it to be clear that they're not, you know, whizzing off the edge of the Zeppelin.
That'd be fun, though.
It might, you know.
It'd
be a weird thrill, you know, especially if you don't have to jump afterwards. That's the secret. And these biplanes, the Sparrowhawks themselves, are incredibly small. These are single-seater biplanes. These were stored, as Noel said, on the Akron itself. Eight Sparrowhawks were produced to test this concept. And if you look at the visual of how they deployed and attached these things, it's terrifying. Because just as important as the diminutive size of the Sparrowhawk was the creation of the trapeze system. It's almost, it reminds me a little bit of, it was when one of the Christopher Nolan Batmans where they use Skyhook.
Oh, man. Yeah, exactly.
And I think enough time's passed that we can talk about that, right?
Yeah, it's not even that big a spoiler. It's a pretty cool moment, though. But hey, let's do a little 3-2-1 countdown to spoiler. 3-2-1 spoiler, get over it.
In the Nolan film, Bruce Wayne, also spoiler, that's Batman's real identity.
Oh, my God!
Casey is livid. Sorry. Sometimes when we crack these jokes, we lean back so we can stare at Casey through his super producer window. And he's a tough crowd sometimes.
He is.
But Skyhook in this story is a mechanism invented, I think, by an intelligence agency or some branch of the military in the U.S., and it's able to scoop people and things up from a flying vessel.
And this is real. There was a CIA program called Skyhook that
yes.
was designed to extract agents in the field at a moment's notice and just have them, boom. It was like some kind of parachute thing where he jumped out of a window, the parachute opened up, there was a beacon on it, so he's kind of gliding along, and then the airplane scoops him up off of a hook or a ring or something on the parachute and lifts him back up into the plane.
And this idea of hooking something in midair is really what the trapeze mechanism is about.
But with way lower tech.
Way lower tech, and not much. It doesn't seem like there's much of a margin for error.
Oh my God! I mean, what? So they would lower the plane down on this wire.
Yeah.
And then the plane would have to start up, mm-hmm. right? And then they would release it, and it would go. My question, Ben, is how do they snatch them back up if the engine's running? Can a plane just idle in place? Like, I'm no airplane scientist, but you know, Ben.
Right. And I don't even have my master's in Zeppelins.
Do you have your amateur in it, though, don't you?
I have my armchair degree.
There you go. So give it to us.
Yeah. So when we think about the way these Zeppelins or airships in general operate, they have the ability to just float. Because of that lighter-than-air gas, they can, you know, reduce speed and not lose altitude. So these Sparrowhawks, which were also, by the way, referred to as parasite fighters, because they lived on this other ship.
Did they clean the plankton from between its teeth?
Well, that wouldn't be parasitic then. That would be more symbiotic.
Oh, my bad.
Well, I mean, I guess it's a sort of symbiosis, but it would be more beneficial.
That's fair. And, you know, Zeppelins don't have teeth. It was a dumb joke. We're cutting it.
No, let's keep it in.
Okay,
I don't
fine.
Think it's dumb.
All right, we'll keep it.
It's
we'll
cool.
It. All right, cool.
And they were getting weird with it anyway, right? So teeth, why not?
Why not?
But the
they had ribs.
They had ribs. There we go. So the Sparrowhawk flies beneath the Zeppelin, and then it has to go very carefully and just hook back on and then kill the engine, and then they take it back up into the Zeppelin.
And I guess it would stay balanced because of the equal weight of the wings on each side. It wouldn't just flop over, you know, once it was hooked. But wouldn't that be terrifying?
Yes. Yeah, it would be incredibly terrifying. Now, of course, we know one strange thing about humanity is, in general, how quickly the most bizarre and dangerous things can become normal. And, of course, these pilots, especially ones who did the first historic quote-unquote landings, were pros. This was what they were on Earth to do. That's Lieutenant Daniel W. Harrigan and Lieutenant Howard L. Young.
And the thing about the Akron, this is the first of two of these big mothers that were built. It was never really used in combat. I think it was mainly just tested and kind of used in these trial flights. Isn't that right, Ben?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It had its first flight on September 23rd, 1931, and then it had a month's worth of test flights. You can read all about this in the USS Akron and the Rise, Fall, and Rise of Airships on OhioHistoryHost.org. That comes from the State Library of Ohio. They had extensive testing, as you would, because this is the first time the U.S. Navy has attempted anything like this.
Right.
I mean, there are experiments that militaries have done with hot air balloons, sure, and this is the age of the airship, but this is the first time anybody had said, let's remember exhibit on Pimp My Ride?
Of course.
It's like, yo, we heard you like aircraft, so we're going to put some aircraft in your aircraft.
There you go.
You know?
Yeah. And also maybe like some ground effects and spinner rims.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you feel about that kind of stuff?
You know what? They would look dumb on a Sparrowhawk, but if you own it and it makes you happy, you should do it.
I know, but those shows, don't they usually like take your car and do all this stuff like without your knowledge, and then they present it to you and you're like, cool. What if you didn't like it? What if it was an affront?
I'm sure they have like three producers who are there just to handle it. It does seem extravagant.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it seems like they went too far. And it's like, hey, man, remember that one time you mentioned donuts? We knocked out the back half of your van and built a Dunkin' Donuts. And this guy lives in there now.
I want to see Pimp My Blimp.
I would watch that so often.
Yes.
I would rewatch episodes of it.
I would watch the pilot, which will be the only episode, multiple times.
Yeah, maybe they could get to six. I don't know if it would make it to season two.
I'm not sure either, because there's only like, how many blimps could there be left in the world now, right?
The number might surprise you, yeah.
Really? There's more than you would think?
Yes, because there are a few classified, very high altitude blimps that are primarily
Zeppelins
for surveillance.
Or blimps?
It's an interesting question, Noel, because if the primary difference between a blimp and a Zeppelin is that rigid shell, I would be more tempted to err on the side of a Zeppelin of some sort of structure beneath the, you know, the balloon, for lack of a better word, or within it, rather, Lockheed Martin has been making something called the High Altitude Airship. It's an unmanned airship.
Whoa.
Yeah, and it floats about over 60,000 feet in the air at a quasi-stationary position.
And it's just checking us all out and just keeping tabs?
Surveillance aircraft, telecommunications, or a weather observer.
Okay, cool.
Well, kind of creepy, though.
That is super creepy. But let's get back to WW2. I do want to point out that this is kind of this episode in general. I feel like is a sort of a sequel to the sausage episode, mm-hmm. with the sausage skins being used for the Zeppelins in World War One, because the Americans kind of got inspired by mm-hmm. that use of the Zeppelins by the Germans, and felt like it was a potentially great strategic move. Even though in that episode we talked about, it wasn't the most successful program in WW1 with the Germans. They didn't really have that many successful kills comparatively. It was they were notoriously easy to spot and slow moving and potentially easy to shoot down.
Yeah,
but yet the Americans thought it was a smart idea to have a fleet of our own.
And we don't want a defense gap, right? That's what all this is about. That's why all those crazy crazy remote viewing experiments occurred, too, much later in history, decades later. But the USS Akron, it turns out, wasn't that great.
No.
It had a lot of bumps in the road. It spent, from what we found, it spent a massive amount of time undergoing repairs,
yep.
as well as trial flights, and people kept saying, look, on paper, this is a great idea. This is worth trying, but we still need to test it again and again, and then things began to go seriously wrong.
Yeah, it's true, Ben. During the 2 years the USS Akron was in service, it was not the most shining example of a military program success. During one of its kind of demonstration flights, I guess, like a test trial flight, mm-hmm. it traveled from Lakehurst, New Jersey, to Sunnyvale, California, and it took a stop along the way at Camp Kearney near San Diego. And there is some pretty harrowing newsreel footage of this that made it into theaters at the time of several sailors who have gotten tangled in the mooring lines, which were these like long wires that were used to ground the ships and tether them down, you know, to park them, I guess. And they're literally attached to these wires. I don't know how this happens, but it's like a bundle of humans attached to this line being lifted up into the air against their will, and then one by one, boop, they just drop off and fall to their death.
Untangling at the worst possible time.
Yeah, it's really rough. It's only two of the soldiers fell to their death, excuse me, but you can see this footage if you just type in USS Akron deaths, mm-hmm. if you want. It's nothing grisly. It's a long shot, but you do see the full fall and the impact and the dust just popping up, and it's like they did not make it. That was a seriously long fall.
Mm-hmm. And despite this disaster, the Navy decided we're going to continue experimenting with the Akron, and they sent it on other flights, including patrols of Cuba, the Panama Canal, until, that is, the airship encountered severe weather on April 4th, 1933.
And this severe weather is a theme that's going to come up again. Clearly, weather was the worst enemy of the Zeppelin. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was right off the Jersey coast. And of the 76 crew members on board, only three survived when the Akron crashed into the ocean.
Yes, they were vulnerable to gusts of wind. Wind is a huge factor in the performance of a craft like this. If they were encountering high winds when they were attempting to redock with the Akron, it would take the Sparrowhawk pilots several tries, which to me is even more nerve-wracking. Like, I have to go in again. Third time's the charm, I hope.
Is it?
We'll see. So the Akron breaks up rapidly. It sinks into the Atlantic. There's a nearby ship, a German ship actually, that sees the lights hitting the ocean, and they alter their course to investigate. And that's when they pick up three survivors, ultimately. Several other people, well, the vast majority of people, as you said, 73 of the 76 do pass away. Most of the casualties, experts imagine, were caused by drowning and hypothermia because the crew had not been issued life jackets and there had been no time to deploy the single life raft. In many ways, Akron's loss spelled the, not the operative end, but maybe the beginning of the end for U.S. experimentation with militarized airships.
But they had another one we haven't mentioned.
The USS Macon.
Yeah, in a blast of creativity built in Macon.
And also bigger
than
the Akron.
Yeah.
And one of the survivors of the Akron, I believe, was the commander of the Macon, Lieutenant Commander Herbert Wiley.
It's Robins Air Force Base? Is that the base in Macon, I believe?
Yes.
Yeah.
So not only was the Macon much larger than the Akron, it also had a more productive career because they realized more effective ways of using this asset. Stay out of sight just to see and not be seen. And mainly what they did was surveillance, right?
Exactly. But also we haven't really mentioned the whole idea of having these aircraft. You sort of did at the top of the show, but having these aircraft on board, which were not long-range aircraft. These were small, you know, small capacity tank planes.
Yeah.
So you could get them within range of enemy territory and then deploy these planes for surveillance and they could zip around and not be seen as opposed to this big giant, you know, airship just hovering in your airspace. That's going to set off some alarms, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the idea. And with the Macon, they really started thinking, okay, we're on to something here. Akron didn't work out, but we've got Macon. So we're starting to see this threat in the Pacific, right, Ben?
Right. The activity of the Japanese government in the Pacific, right, and expansionist tendencies. So they noticed that Japan had been quickly building up its military. And they were hoping, the U.S. that is, to increase the distance these planes could travel on scouting missions. So now you can do a lot of the heavy lifting by, you know, just putting them on the Macon, putting these Sparrowhawks on the Macon,
mm-hmm.
and then having this fly at a very high altitude over much of the distance. And this is an interesting part. Eventually, on the Macon, it became a standard practice for them to remove the landing gear of the Sparrowhawks and replace it with a fuel tank modification.
Like an extender, kind of? Like give them a little more capacity?
30% more.
Wow, okay. Interesting. Because they never had to land. Well, they got snatched out of the air.
Hopefully.
Or, you know, crashed. We didn't see any evidence of botched sky hook situations, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were some.
Well, I don't know if there was a long enough span of time for one to occur.
That's true.
You know?
That's true. This was more or less an experiment that mm-hmm. kind of fizzled pretty quickly. And it fizzled in the form of another tragic crash.
Right. On February 12th, 1935, the USS Macon also ran afoul of severe weather off the coast of California.
Yeah, and I think at the top of the show, I may have made it sound like these were actively used during World War II, but it was really just technology that was in play leading up to World War II that could have potentially come in handy in a very interesting way that we'll talk about in just a second. But that's right, Ben. The Macon hit that severe weather, the kryptonite to these ships, and it sank very slowly off the California coast, and that was lucky because it saved a lot of lives.
Right, and it's incredibly fortunate that there was this slow, inevitable descent. The crew had enough time to put some life jackets on, and only two people in the crew died, one from jumping into the ocean from too high a distance, and another from swimming back into the galley while it was sinking to retrieve some of his stuff. He drowned.
What are you doing, man? What are you thinking?
Well, who knows? We don't know what he was going to retrieve.
I know. We shouldn't judge. Yeah, but so there we go. That's essentially the end of the airship program. It was just too risky.
Right, at least in terms of manned aircraft, because as we said, the high-altitude airships that at least five countries are working on building now are all unmanned. Mm-hmm. That is one of the big differences between them and something like the Akron or the Macon, with which whom they share a lot of DNA. There's an interesting point you alluded to, Noel, that I think we should emphasize here explore a bit, which is that for a lot of military historians, the story of war is also a story of what-if-ery.
Of course.
So what would have happened if the Akron and the Macon had not crashed?
Well, given what we talked about with their ability to kind of like get close to enemy territory and then send these guys out that were much less easy to detect, there's a potential that they could have spotted an event, a very important event, in advance and possibly headed it off at the pass.
Had the USS Macon been in service and active in 1941, it may well have been able to send warning of the Japanese fleet headed to Pearl Harbor. However, it was not active, and as a result, the course of history was set.
Yeah, and, you know, no other dirigibles of this kind were ever commissioned for use as aircraft carriers. And I think it's super cool that they still exist in some capacity, in that unmanned capacity that you mentioned, Ben. But
you don't think that's a little creepy?
And it's no creepier than anything else, you know, than
drones. It's no creepier than Facebook.
Oh, wow. You really took it. You really took it to a place there. No, it's all pretty creepy, Ben. But you get to a point where you just get so comfortable with your ability to play words with friends that that you can have all my data. It's fine. Just take it.
I want to point out that Facebook is also developing a high-altitude flying wing UAV.
Is that true?
That is true.
Wow.
It's
to what end?
It's designed to stay aloft for like 90 days. The stated purpose is to provide internet connectivity. So maybe
to like remote areas, maybe where you don't have infrastructure.
Okay, yeah.
That's cool. I'm sure there's no other underhanded, secret, creepy motive for it.
Well, and do remember, folks, that as my co-host mentioned here, you can go see newsreel footage of not just these airships in action, but another thing as well.
Yeah, the more recently, a crew, in 2015 actually, a underwater crew a la like James Cameron, you know, went and explored the wreckage of the USS Macon and made some amazing like photo mosaic shots of it where, you know, you take photos from all different angles and there is real video you can see where they, you know, you can see the galley and all of the different spaces that would have been, you know, occupied in this giant airship. It's pretty cool. And you can actually see it at the article on How Stuff Works called Ridiculous History, the U.S. Navy Used Dirigibles as Flying Aircraft Carriers by Laurie L. Dove. There's a link at the bottom to a YouTube clip of the feed from one of these expeditions. It's pretty cool stuff. And yeah, currently it's still there, 1,400 feet below the surface of the ocean. And there is a concern that because of the salt water that all of this stuff is going to eventually just degrade to nothing. So it's pretty cool that you see it. It was actually made a historic place by the National Register in mm-hmm. 2010.
So do check it out. Let us know what you think. Would you ride in an airship? I think most people would say, of course, as long as there's no one shooting at me. If you'd like to learn more about airships, you can check out our previous episode we mentioned earlier in the show. You can also check out The Rise and Fall of Airships on our peer podcast, Car Stuff. And speaking of Facebook, hey, guess what? We're on it.
Boy, are we ever. We're on Facebook. You can check us out there at Ridiculous History. I am really digging the Facebook group, The Ridiculous Historians. There's some really smart people on there having really smart, interesting conversations. We've been popping in there here and there and having some fun. And yeah, so you can check that out. If you're interested in being a moderator or something, that sort of thing floats your boat, let us know at ridiculous@howstuffworks.com.
As always, we'd like to thank Casey Zeppelin Pegram. What do you think? Is that going to work?
I'll take it.
CZP, I'm into it. Yeah.
And I personally would like to thank Lockheed Martin for keeping airships alive in some form.
Yeah, keep the dream alive, man. The X-Men dream.
And of course, thanks to our composer, Alex Williams. I love that we can say we have a composer.
Oh man, it's the best.
It feels like such a cool thing to drop in conversation. Like, anyway, I was talking to my composer. Well,
to be fair, he only wrote one song for us.
But
he's not technically our composer.
He composed it.
He did. It's true. What if he composed just the soundtracks of our lives? We just had his music playing when we walked into a room, you know?
That'd be great. He has fantastic taste in music.
He really does.
I mean, you do too. I'm not dinging you. That's just Casey, of course. And
is this the big up section of the show, or we big up each other and our pals?
Yeah.
I like it.
So I think it's a cool regular thing to end on. But of course, the biggest of ups go to you, specifically you, friends and neighbors. Thank you so much for tuning in.
And we hope you'll tune in again next time for another episode of Ridiculous History. Goodbye, everyone.